Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church, and I'm not really sure what I believe anymore.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff, and I'm an evangelical.
And this is Veterans of Culture Wars.
Why would you do this to me again?
I don't know where you lay your head or where you call your home.
This is our normal intro music. I don't know what you're talking about.
Meals or where you talk
it's
on the phone.
Just a 4-minute long intro.
I don't know if you got a cook, a brother, or a maid. I don't know if you got a yard.
And I'm going to manually fade the show. So.
What did I ever
okay.
do to you?
If anybody out there is still listening after that, this is...
I'm the Paul Rudd to your Conan.
Anytime we interact now for the next 20 years.
Yes.
This is, what podcast are we? Veterans of Culture Wars, where we talk about the beliefs, history, culture, and personal stories from evangelical Christianity. We welcome you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. Zach, a return guest.
Yeah. Joel Hanghartsy is here. You heard him popping in to voice his extreme pleasure with the musical choice. This is, of course, our 2022 theme song. And last time he was on here was early 2021. So he heard, the classic version of the theme song. No, that's not the case. That was Lil Markey performing Big House. Joel, you were among our first handful of guests. Your episode title is still my favorite title of anything that we've done. If anybody wants to listen to it, they can go and do that. Saying it's a pun that doesn't make sense unless I give a backstory. So, and you're here. I mean, we could be talking about the Mariners and other faith struggles. But what you're actually here to talk about is the book that you told us you were finishing up last time you were on. It is out-ish. It is.
It's 100% officially
out. 100% officially out and readable in physical book form. And it is called Dancing About Architecture is a Reasonable Thing to Do. A collection of various writings, mostly having to do with music. From your many years of doing cultural criticism and personal journeys into musical discovery and such. I don't know exactly how to put that, but
yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I read it and it was really fun. There's a lot of stuff that I connected with for sure. And we'll get into specifics in a little bit, but welcome to the show. You've been doing
a few others. I was disappointed your podcast isn't called Veterans of Christian Wars, because I'm trying to only do podcasts with Christian in the name right now. So
all right. Yeah, did, you're on Good Christian Fun.
And then I did Bad Christian, which was pretty fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, and then I did one called Good Patron. I guess that one's not, but it did have good in it. So each one needs to have a word that's in the previous one. So this one broke that chain, unfortunately. But
back and found an episode that you did in like 2 years ago on some other podcast, talking specifically about
Christian rock.
Yes. Talking just about Page of the Line. And within a couple minutes, Emery got mentioned. But on the Bad Christian Fun podcast, you're like, I'd never heard of your band until.
Well, so I started listening to them a few years ago. So I had, that was all true.
But, yeah. I'd never heard of them until they had a podcast.
Well,
so.
And it's funny too, as I mentioned to them that I lived in Seattle at that time, but somehow that genre just passed me by, whatever that was. It's funny how the genres work that way. But anyway, this new book, which is what I'm here to talk about is.
Yeah.
It's a collection of, it's sort of half. Apology or apologia in the classical sense, I guess, for why music criticism can or should exist. Even though I'm kind of a skeptic of that myself, I've done it for a long time. And then half of it is sort of attempts to do that. So the old saying, writing about music is like dancing about architecture, is meant to sort of imply that. It's sort of a cute, funny way of saying, well, how could you ever really do that, right? How could you ever really capture how could you capture that ineffable je ne sais quoi about sound and, the movement of vibrations? How could you capture that in just dead letters on a page. And my point in this book is one, to say that like, that's not really what it's for. That's not why people write about music. And then two, to say that like, even if that is a difficult thing to attempt, it's worth doing. And here are like some of my attempts to do it and to explain why it's worthwhile. So that's kind of what it's
about. Yeah. And it's really great. But as a kind of opening question, I mean, I'm a white guy, a cis white guy. Is it reasonable to want me to dance to architecture?
Well, as I mentioned, it's just a metaphor. You don't actually have to dance.
All right. But, thanks. I don't know if people want to see that, honestly.
I did refer to something I call the Ben Gibbard leg dance, also known as the Chris Walla leg dance in this, which is the type of dancing that I would recommend any middle-aged white man try to attempt, which is you stand, you can be wearing a guitar or not. So the nice thing about this is whether you are in Death Cab for Cutie or simply at a Death Cab for Cutie concert, the dance is the same, which actually gets to my point of how being a fan and being in a band aren't so different after all. But the idea is that you stand there, you want to show that you're enjoying the music, but you don't have a lot of rhythm. You just start really moving your right leg, and you don't lift it off the ground. You just kind of are pivoting on the balls of your feet, and you're kind of, you know, you move a little, but you just, everybody around you knows that you're feeling it as much as you could be. So yeah.
Maybe you hold your elbow.
You could, yeah.
Not if you're playing an instrument, you know.
If you're in a band photo, you should definitely hold your elbow.
Yeah,
I highly recommend holding your elbow. Any photo that was ever taken of my band in college, I made sure to do that because I always thought it looked really
cool. You never know what's going to happen to that elbow if you don't support it like that.
were you the one guy looking at the camera while everyone else looked away?
It's tricky. As the drummer, you don't often get that role. There is one photo where I am the only one looking at the camera, and I felt it was misleading because it implied that I was the front man of the band, which I decidedly was not. So,
I don't know the answer to this off the top of my head. Which member of Weezer is holding their elbow on the Blue Album?
Oh, man.
I think it's Brian Rivers.
Bell. Oh, is it? Somebody needs to look it up.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up real quick here. Let's see.
I don't think it was Rivers.
I think it's Brian Bell. No, Brian Bell has his hands in his pockets. Matt Sharp is clasping his hands.
Oh, nobody's doing it. Ugh.
Oh,
I thought one of them was.
I think the closest you're going to get is Matt Sharp's doing kind of the fig leaf.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, very important.
Yeah. Issues. I thought I had a real gotcha there. but you survived the gauntlet unscathed. Good job. That metaphor saying that writing about music is like dancing about architecture. It's interesting in a few ways. It seems a lot of my, I don't want to say complaints. I don't think that music criticism is supposed to be about complaining anyways, but a lot of my issues with music criticism I've read over the years is they don't attempt to dance about architecture. They make it a one-to-one thing. We're going to write about the writing. We're going to just examine the lyrical content.
Right.
And that's an apples to apples comparison, you know?
Right.
There's no, you're not twisting yourself into a pretzel to come up with a way to figure out how to describe words.
Yeah. You know? That's true. I mean, somebody else asked me about that at the book launch last week. I didn't have a very good answer for it, I don't think, because it's just natural to want to do that. Like, that's what's most prominent in a lot of this. But I think the best music writing, like if you look at how people write about instrumental, you know, I don't really follow like the world of writing about classical or jazz. That's kind of its own genre. Mm-hmm. And actually writing about jazz is probably some of the most self-indulgent. Like, how did they come up with that mishmash of words to describe that? But I think probably jazz writing is where that gets really fun. And that might be where some of the rock writing originally came from. So I don't know how you feel about somebody like Lester Bangs or kind of those early like gonzo rock journalists. But to me, part of the fun of maybe that or some of the jazz writing like in the 60s is like trying to come up with a vocabulary to describe mm-hmm. new sounds, right? Like this was new. Like jazz, we forget, right? That jazz, even something as simple as like bebop from the 50s, which we think of as this, now we would see as like very conservative, was like no one had ever heard anything like that before. I read this book last year about John Coltrane, and they had this, he had this technique called sheets of sound, where he would just try to play as many notes as he could in a scale in as quick a succession as possible. And that really struck me because I was familiar with the term wall of sound describing Phil Spector's production, but that's something completely different from what Coltrane was doing, even though it sounds like you're kind of saying, you know, sheets of sound, wall of sound. So I think a lot of it is like grasping at like, there's something like new and novel in the world that you're trying to, maybe grasping is the wrong word, but it's like, we're trying to put a name or a shape to something that we couldn't, that didn't exist before, and that we're trying to make sense of. This is a new thing in the world now. And that to me is what's been really exciting to me about writing about music, even if it's not about the sound. Like I think the best music criticism, it talks about the subjective experience of listening. And that's, I tried to talk a little bit about that in this book, but there's a scholar, Peter Elbow, I think I mentioned him in another interview I did, but he talks about when you're critiquing something, the best you can do is give the person what he calls a movie of your mind. Like, what is capture your subjective experience when you encountered the thing. And that's what I've always really liked about the best music journalism that I've read, is like, it's not just about the sound, it's not just about the lyrics, it's about the overall experience. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Speaking of Johnny Coltrane and rock critics, do you have a quote?
Johnny Coltrane. Johnny,
yes.
You're on a, I didn't realize you were on such a familiar basis.
Yes, there. Right. Yeah, me and him go way back. Yeah. Love Supreme's a great album. So you have a quote at the beginning of your book and also in the intro from Richard Meltzer, who is a rock critic and also a philosopher. And you quote him as saying, "The art critic can never be epistemologically capable of describing art by thinking at being, but must think from and within being. I have thus deemed it a necessity to describe rock and roll by allowing my description to be itself a parallel artistic effort." So how does this quote inform your work, your book, and then how you approach music criticism?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that, so I never finished that book, The Aesthetics of Rock. It's very hard to read. And Meltzer is kind of one of those original gonzo rock writers. Zach, I don't know if you remember his column. Michelangelo Matos actually hired him to do a column for the Seattle Weekly in the early 2000s. Do you ever read that?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember seeing his name in the local press. Yeah.
So
I heard you talking on Bad Christian about the rocket. And yeah. And I was like, oh man, that takes me back for those that never lived over here. And sorry, I didn't want to interrupt, but Seattle used to be so great for reading music criticism and reading about music that we had a weekly paper that was only about music. I still have some copies of it. I think the final one is Page of the Lion on the cover.
Oh, wow.
It's like 10 feet away from me right now.
I love it. Whenever I think about that, I'm just like, did I dream that? Like, did that really exist? Especially now that like all of the alt weeklies are dying. But The Village Voice, right? Which is the start of rock criticism, that, you know, that ceased publication within the last decade as well. But this quote, I read this book. I had to take an aesthetics class. Well, I didn't have to. I did this master's degree in English and I didn't want to do literature anymore, but they made me take a literature class. I was like getting into the teaching writing stuff. And I was like, well, I'll take this aesthetics class because I can like probably find a way to make it about something I'm interested in. So we read Middlemarch, which is a great book, although I didn't read like the last 30 pages of it. And then
you're like me with not finishing books.
I finished your book, as I already said. I try to finish the books I start. But
I appreciate that. I mean, to my credit, Middlemarch is like 600 pages long.
Yeah, okay.
Right. Fair. Fair.
Anyway, but the other thing I did was I decided to write my paper for the seminar on how is music criticism possible, and that's actually the third kind of long chapter at the beginning of this book became that. So that's where all that kind of aesthetics theory came from. But I read this book, The Aesthetics of Rock by Richard Meltzer, and that sentence stopped me in my tracks, this notion that the description of the music is driven by the same spirit that the music itself is. And that resonated with me so much. That's the argument I tried to make in the early parts of this book, is that, like, I'm not saying that somehow, like, what I do or what another publish, you know, like music writer who publishes, I'm not saying what we do is like exactly the same as what a band does or whatever, or what a musician does, but I have to see it as all being a part of the same. And I've heard lots of words described, and I've used lots of words for this, the same endeavor, effort, ecosystem, I've heard someone say. I like to use the word orbit a lot. Like, I think we're orbiting around the central core of something meaningful, and we're all, or dancing, we're all dancing around the same thing, and we all participate in it. And I try to argue, one of the ways I argue that is the chapter about Weezer, where my argument that I try to make, and Zach, you may recognize that chapter from my failed 33 and a third proposal, because that's what I turned it into. But you know, that what we think of as being that band is partly or maybe largely formed by the criticism that's been written about them, the fan comments about them over the years, the community that or what we would call the discourse community that's built up around them. And I just think, rather than see that as like parasitic or less than, or, you know, those who can't do, just kind of siphon that off of that, I don't see it that way at all. I think that it is, it's all, as John Coltrane says in the other epigraph to the book, it all has to do with it. It's all of a piece. So that's,
yeah, that it makes sense. Cause yeah, you're talking about, nobody can approach art, music, movies, paintings from a completely objective standpoint. We're all bringing our experiences, our spirituality or non-spirituality. Everything comes when we're engaging with the work of art. So I like how you put it. It's not like it's the same as the art itself that we're commenting on, but music criticism or film criticism or whatever can build on that foundation of what they created, because all of these different people are bringing their own life stories and their own experiences, like, into the medium.
I think my favorite arts criticism in general is coming from a personal point of view. I mean, that's why I end up following particular critics and wanting to read what they have to say about and inspired by interacting with some work, rather than just, I don't know, going to Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic or whatever, and just finding whatever the positive ones are and reading them, or whatever the negative ones are and reading them. Like, I feel like I have a relationship as a reader with certain critics. If you've seen the movie Everything Everywhere All at Once, Walter Cha has an incredible piece about it that has to do with his experience as an Asian American with parents he could never please, and the difficult experiences of being their son. And it's entirely about him and his life wrapped up in this review, and it's beautiful and amazing, and you really learn something about the movie and about the person, and I love that sort of stuff.
That's the best, yeah.
It really is. A few quotes in the book kind of make similar points about this argument that music only really exists as performance, that music is not complete until it is enacted in front of a crowd or something. And as somebody who has released music that I have never played in front of other people, I am offended, sir.
I don't think I was actually arguing for that. That's from a section where I'm kind of playing around with the idea of, like, what do recordings mean versus live performance and stuff like that. Because it used to be you could only interact with music in person. That was the only way you could do it. So you could only have an immediate visceral response to actual physical thing that was happening to you. And that's cool. Obviously, we all enjoy when that can happen. But, like, there's something that we've been afforded by, like, mechanical and then digital reproduction that allows not only for the music to be experienced differently, but for this goes beyond the argument I was making there, but also for the medium of criticism to extend, like, into the sort of create a conversation from the past to the future, right? Like, we now, you can, the notion that you can sit down and see, like you were saying, like, what a certain critic has to say about a certain piece of art, and you can discover that 50 years later, that's amazing. Like, that it's become such a stretched out, it's the time scale has been has been, there's probably a good $3 word for this, but it's like the time scale has been stretched out so that more people can participate, which is cool.
There's several longer passages in the book that are stories that I found fascinating. The first one I want to talk about is your interview with Slim Moon. Moon is the founder of Kill Rock Stars Records out of Olympia, super influential, independent punk label, known primarily for their involvement with Riot Girl stuff, you know, Bikini Kill, Huggy Bear was my favorite of those. One of my favorite live bands ever, Shoplifting, was on there in the early 2000s. He became a Unitarian Universalist minister. And bit of advice that he gives that you were well aware of, but it's nice to see it in print. He lets you know that if they're unfamiliar with underground music, we do not call these performances concerts. They are shows. That was explained to me very clearly in high school by like the first punk I met. He's like, I'm playing a show. We have shows. We're doing it this show. And it was the only word that we could use. But I remember seeing Slim perform in the early 2000s during the first term of George W. Bush. Did a spoken word thing at some all day long punk event at a warehouse. And he led everybody outside, encouraging everybody to all chant together, "Fuck the motherfucking president." And so it was insane to, in your book, read him say that he had attended and enjoyed Hillsong and Bethel music events. I cannot wrap my head around this.
It's pretty wild. And that was before I heard you talking on your last episode about that New York Times piece. This interview, I should stress, was done in I think this was before Trump was elected. So it was a little bit before that had come to its fullest,
full fruition,
most evil form or whatever. But no, it was that whole thing I was so fascinated by that. And again, part of it was the personal story for me. As I say in the book,
you almost worked there.
Well, I mean, who knows?
You applied.
I was looking for a job when I was finishing college, and I was like, oh, I bet I could apply for a record label. So I applied at like KEXP. I applied at Kill Rock Stars, and I ended up getting a job in fundraising for a Catholic social service agency, which shows kind of maybe what path I was actually on.
Very, very similar.
KEXP turned me down because I didn't have any underwriting experience, even though I had run a bit of a rinky-dink radio station at our college. And then for Kill Rock Stars, I was like, well, you know what? I've worked in this music promo world. I've been interacting with these people as the music director. I know a bit about this world. So I kind of gave them my spiel. And then he just sent me this single email. The more power you have, the shorter your emails can be. I don't know if you've noticed this. And it was in all lowercase letters and just said, can you come to Oli for an interview? He didn't even spell out Olympia. That's how cool he was. And I was terrified. I felt like I would be seen, you know, they would see through me. They would find out I was just this kind of like small timey Christian college kid. And it would be, I'd be too uncool and I wouldn't have the right politics somehow, even though I was very like left-leaning. And I just chickened out and I was like, oh man, you know, I think I'm gonna like go to grad school instead or something. I just like kind of chickened out. And then to find out, yeah, that he was like very into God and like worship music years later, it was hilarious to me.
There's a really cool quote in him where he says, music touches us in a way that is beyond verbal, and to get really mystical, it's like we're made. It's hard to figure out what evolutionary purpose our musicality serves, but we're clearly built to be made to really respond strongly to music, not just to the big things like a drum beat, but a very, very subtle piece of music would still have strong emotional responses. That would resonate with me even more a few years ago, I suppose, but it certainly sounds like he's saying that the existence of music and the way that that he feels when he hears it is proof of God.
I think in a sense that, yeah, that is what he's saying. And that's what's always attracted me to these types of things. I've said before, like the things that I find endlessly fascinating and mysterious about the human experience are language, music, and love. Like, I don't understand why those things exist if we're just going with a strictly materialist, this is just all kind of here explanation. Why on earth is the nuances and the subtleties of those things? And whatever, there are sciencey explanations for all those things. I understand that, but the richness of the affective experience of those things and the subjective experience of those things, to me, they're absolutely signposts to something, something holy, something other.
Two of those three seem related to me, whereas I think, a fundamental desire of human nature is to be known. And I think language and love are two of the ways that we can be most known. But music is separate from those. Music seems entirely distinct from that.
Well,
and yeah.
To quote one of my favorite Seattle bands, United State of Electronica, and Noah Star Weaver of our own alma mater.
I keep getting recommended to follow him on IG.
music, he's an interesting one because they ended up going to Bethel, which is a whole other thing. But what he said in a USC song.
House once.
Cool. We're really getting off track here. I was about to make this very poignant comment.
Yes. Okay. We'll edit that out.
Here's what I like about that band. So I talk about that band in this book, United State of Electronica. And what is really fun about that band, Noah is very clearly just a 100% committed Christian. Like, you talk to him, that is very clear right away. He's just a very open-hearted person who loves God. Like, there's never been any question about that. United State of Electronica is certainly not a Christian band. In fact, I was able to use a phrase that I really loved in that piece, which is that describing that band is, I said, they fuck shit up for the Lord, which is one of the favorite things I've ever written. But nothing about that band suggests that they're Christian. They're just kind of a goofy, fun dance band that's about partying. But if you listen to a lot of their songs, they're actually secretly super, super, super Christian. But one of the things he says in one of those songs, in just a little throwaway bridge, is music is love. It's love. It's love. And I actually feel that in a way that I almost can't articulate. There is something to me about, and maybe it's because I've had so many powerful experiences of making music or being involved in music scenes or even experiencing music in my family growing up. I always have experienced music as something that is shared between people, and that is that I see as a gift. So to me, there's an act both in the performance of music and also, I guess, in choosing to become a part of that scene or in choosing to listen to it. There's a sense of of self-giving that I find really beautiful. So I'm not doing a very good job of explaining why I think that music and love are actually the same thing, but I've always kind of felt that way.
Yeah. I'm picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah.
And to go along in that theme, you, again, early in the book, you quote Rich Mullins, who I am still a big fan of, and he died in the late 90s in a horrible car accident, probably around my age when that happened. And you have this quote from him to go along with kind of this thread that we're talking about. Of all things, music is the most frivolous and the most useless. You can't eat it, you can't drive it, you can't live in it, you can't wear it, but your life wouldn't be worth much without it. And so again, kind of talking about how art or music can perhaps point to something transcendent, depending on what we believe. And I think, the biggest cliche, and I'm not a musician at all, so the role that music plays in my life is kind of that cliche idea that music is a soundtrack to us living. Like, I think about the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album and some of their greatest hits records, and I think about Creedence Clearwater Revival. That was the music I grew up with when my family would go camping. And so I listened to that music, and I remember going down the Oregon coast. I listened to contemporary Christian rock music, mid-90s, like DC Talk that we talked about the first time we talked to you, Jars of Clay, Newsboys, Take Me to Your Leader, Audio Adrenaline Bloom. And I remember being a new Christian, maybe a Christian for a year, and being in youth group. And we had a really great youth group and a youth leader who treated us, you know, like young adults and taught us cool things and theology and stuff like that. And I remember those days, and it the soundtrack of life kind of brings up all these rich memories, and that makes music like really transcendent in my life. But are there particular albums that do that for you, Joel, that you go to and you remember like really specific cool times in your life, and it brings
absolutely
all
that
back?
Yeah. Oh, totally. I think
sweater.
We've talked a lot about Weezer. That's all. That's
I know. Yeah. I mean, I could. I have some. I have many fond memories about Weezer, but you know, but a lot of music. And I think that notion of like songs, like the way I would say it is like they play into your life, or you live into them in a way that even, and maybe this is about that kind of relationship between fan and critic and artist and how we're all part of it. I think that we live songs in ways that the people who wrote and performed them don't necessarily. I think about like, you know, there's like, okay, here's kind of a cheesy example, but like, so Ben Folds has this very, very well-known ballad called The Luckiest, right? Have you heard this song? It's a little bit schlocky, but it's this piece about, you know, this sort of finding the love of your life. And it's very, very sweet. You would think, oh, he must have really felt something, you know, must have really meant something to him and his wife at the time. First of all, that guy's been married like 7 times. I'm not exaggerating. But also, I remember he said in an interview, look, and he was divorcing the woman who people thought ostensibly the song was about. And he said, look, I forget exactly how he said it, but he's like, it's just a song that I wrote. Like it didn't have anything to do with like, basically what he was saying was you can put what meaning you think onto me, but like I just wrote this song. And I think it's up to other people to like live that song into their life. So yeah, for me, like Simon and Garfunkel is like family road trips. So like we still put on Graceland if we're driving somewhere, and like it's just I feel like a kid again, and I'm like excited about what's going to happen next, like where are we going, what are we gonna, just that sound of that the bass coming in on the song Graceland, I feel like I'm driving down the road already. When I hear Dreams by the Cranberries, I instantly have the sensation of finding out that a girl in high school liked me and she was going to become my first girlfriend. Like, and it's an incredible feeling. I almost feel, yeah. It's almost like when I hear that song, it's almost like a, you know, whatever chemical in my brain, it's like a drug. It's like, oh yeah, that's good. You know, that kind of thing. What else is there? I don't know. There are certain things. Those are the most like the strongest ones that come to mind. But there's so many of those, right? Like, it's just such a powerful thing to, it accompanies us, if you want to say, as a soundtrack. And that's the very last thing in here is, I don't know if this is, I think this is allowed based on artistic like copyright license or whatever, but I created what's called a found poem, right, which is where you rearrange something into a poetic form from a radio interview that Sufjan Stevens did in 2016. And one of the things he says, music is transcendent. It's an invisible force. It's an apparition of consequence, sound waves you can't see. And I feel like that's kind of a representation of God. Music is like the practice of faith through song. Music persuades us to believe in something we cannot see. It offers meaning and narrative and consciousness and hope in something invisible. It's a salve, but it cannot really save us. It can only accompany us on our journey for a season. And I really like that. I think, and he goes on to say what he thinks, you know, how he thinks music relates to God. But I like that notion of like, this is something, it accompanies us. It's not just to be cool or fun or like, and that's when I think about music criticism too. It's like, when I started, it was definitely about like, I want to show that I have good taste. I want to show that I know a lot. I want to show that I know all the right words to describe music. You know, how many times, Zach, have you seen one of your favorite post-punk bands described as angular?
Right.
Like what on earth does that really mean? But at some point it was like, no, what I love about this is what I want to help capture about this is some of those things that he's talking about, and that is the transcendence or the thought that it's accompanying you on a journey of your life, like those things that really are meaningful, not just you know, that you I don't know, like that you know the right way to, or that you can like write a dismissive, snarky you know, pan of Nickelback or something to show that.
Right.
Yeah.
on that topic, not of Nickelback, but in general of like taste and wanting to like know the right things or whatever early on, you mentioned arguably the most influential bit of music criticism in the last 15 years or so. Carl Wilson's 33 and a Third book, Let's Talk About Love. The subtitle is Why Other People Have Such Bad Taste, which is extraordinary. Apparently, well, I don't know. I tried to write up some joke about, you know, he has the same name as the Beach Boy that died in 1998 and sang on God Only Knows, to bring it back to what Dave was talking about. But no, different guy. It was still kind of confusing when I started seeing his name pop up. what is this book, and what did you learn from it?
Yeah, it's a great book. So I commend the 33 and a Third series to anyone. It's a wonderful series of books, and I
have a few of them. Yeah,
though I've tried many times to get them to publish a book by me, it has not worked out yet. But to my you know, in my defense, many hundreds of people are also vying for those few spots. But yeah, so it's a book about the Celine Dion album. What's the name of it?
Let's Talk About
it's
Love.
Called Let's Talk About Love, right? Of course, yeah. And it has the song from Titanic on it, which is probably what most people would have heard of. And the basic premise of the book is like, I, the author, Carl Wilson, am a, you know, hipster Torontonian music critic. And I think that this album is schlocky garbage, basically. But that doesn't seem to be what a lot of other people think. And let's try to figure out why that is. Why do people love something that I hate, that I, as a professional critic, think is sort of objectively bad? And he goes down a lot of different paths trying to figure that out, and gets into some really interesting stuff about her history and why she connects with some people that he might not connect with. So he delves into like, why would non-English speaking people connect with her? Why would people from like rural areas connect with her? Why would the gay community connect with her? And all these different things. And then he sort of comes to the conclusion that taste, so there's a sociological concept from Pierre Bourdieu, who is, most of his work is about like sort of how people differentiate each other from each other in society. So like, how does the middle class show that it's not the lower class, for example? And one of the ways he says that they do that, I mean, he has this whole economic metaphor about cultural capital and accumulating cultural capital. But one of the things he talks about is using taste to distinguish class. So the idea would be like, a great example I've read of this before is like, if you make, and this is back in the day, but if you make $40,000 a year as a construction worker and come home and drink a beer and watch a football game, you're working class. If you make $40,000 a year as a teacher and you come home and drink a glass of wine and listen to NPR, you're middle class, right? So what is class really? Is it actually economic, or is it being marked in other ways? And so although that tends to be maybe the crass way that we try to differentiate ourselves, really what taste could be or should be, and I think the conclusion he and I both come to, it's really about what you love, and maybe what you're able to love is constrained by other factors. But I think, you know, if there's a lesson to be had from that, and I don't know that it's necessarily intended to be, it's that like, maybe we should get away from some of the things that I criticize, like music criticism for, like showing that you're cool, showing, you know, the right bands, and which all of that was for sure what I wanted to do. Like I wanted to be somebody who was known for knowing stuff like that. That was important to me when I was younger, and I became a freaking professor. So obviously I didn't escape it, you know, but like, maybe if this could be about being driven by love, and maybe if this could be about being driven by like pursuing things that really matter to you, regardless of the circumstances, maybe we could get somewhere a little more interesting. And I think he does get somewhere.
It was really helpful for me to just throw out the whole idea of a guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Like I think that guilt comes from the awareness that something is outside of the boundary of cool, and that you're not supposed to like it. But if you like it, you like it. And I think, I don't know, I think I landed there eventually by getting into some outsider music and stuff where people are not technically proficient with the crafts part of their art. And, you know, eventually just like, yeah, if it moves me, then I'm going to call it good.
And that is, and you shouldn't, you know, I think there was this, I mentioned this debate that was in the mid-2000s that music critics had about this notion of rockism versus poptimism. Sure. I don't know if you remember that. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I think that, again, even that is a bit too much of a binary for me. Like, I love rock music because of, like, largely because of the circumstances that I grew up in, the time and place and race and class and all that stuff. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't love it. That doesn't mean that that's not who I am. But I also really like Doja Cat, and that should be okay too. You know what I mean? Like, so
yeah, Pitchfork was obsessed with Lil Wayne for a while, when for a long time they were just like your one-stop shop for In the Aeroplane Over the Sea.
It is still a little jarring to go to Pitchfork and see, you know, Britney Spears announces pregnancy.
Is really wild.
I have another question for you. As you were talking about, I mean, since your book and what you're working on here is between the artist and the relationship between the artist and the audience and the critic, I was going to ask a question like this to Alyssa Wilkinson, who we had on two episodes ago. Had to cut it, though. It was such a great conversation with her. We were asking her lots of stuff. But I was going to ask about artists that are problematic in their personal life. And obviously, we know that all artists have flaws, and sometimes that's what makes the art really interesting, when they sing about that and kind of bring that out. But obviously there are people, like from a cinema art perspective, like Woody Allen, who personal life is beyond just flaws to like actions that are just monstrously evil. But, you know, I was thinking about this when I was going to ask Alyssa this question. You know, in 100 years, people who still love the art of cinema are probably still going to be talking about some of Woody Allen's movies. I mean, masterpieces, and what he has to say about New York and relationships at the end of the 20th century and, you know, into the 21st century and all that. Obviously, there are musicians who are extremely problematic also in their personal lives. How do we navigate that as listeners and critics, like with somebody who does have monstrously evil actions, but their art is beautiful, is transcendent to you, or means something to you in your life? How do you navigate that as a listener?
Boy, that's a really hard question. And it's one that I often ignore.
Right.
One of the advantages, I think, to having had an evangelical upbringing is that I didn't have an opportunity to fall in love with a lot of those problematic artists. Although it turns out
problematic to us is like they stopped believing in Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. it probably comes back around to some of that stuff turning out to have been problematic in the end. But I think there's a difference between people who are sort of like unrepentantly evil, like R. Kelly comes to mind, right? Like,
yeah, right.
That's just heinous. I read that book. I don't know if you've read Jim DeRogatis at all on that, Zach.
I've read articles of his. I haven't read the book.
Yes. Yeah, so I read the book a couple years ago, and it was just awful. And that's an example, actually, of music criticism. True music journalism becoming a force. I mean, it is because of Jim DeRogatis that eventually R. Kelly was arrested. I mean, yeah, it took years, but somebody sent him the tape, you know. It's like he wouldn't let it go. And I think that is really beautiful. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's not something that I think about a lot. I think you have to take it on a case by case basis. I was just texting with my sister today about this author that we both really love from our hometown. I won't mention names, but somebody who had it like a fairly public incident. And I was kind of talking about like, well, what do we think about this now? And it's like, well, I don't know. I'll take it as it comes, I guess. Like there's certain people I wouldn't feel comfortable listening to anymore. And there's others that for whatever reason, they're just so much a part of the culture or of my experience of music, it would be really hard to stop listening. David Bowie is somebody that's mentioned a lot as having had some questionable things early on in his career. It's difficult to imagine not having that as, I don't know. Yeah, I don't have a good answer for it at all. It's very, it's very tricky. Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough for me.
I think it's harder with music.
Yeah.
I think with music, it's harder than with films, because with films, they are so rarely the product ever of a single individual. You know, it's a huge group effort, and getting rid of the work because of a single person is kind of ignoring all the work that went into it from all the other folks. Whereas music can be just the problematic individual as the force behind it, and that makes it a little bit easier to decide it may be best to cut this out for me.
But it's strange. The culture, I mean, the music culture is capricious in some ways. It's difficult. I don't know if you remember, but one of the first instances I remember seeing of true sort of canceling in the sense of like albums not released, tours not happening. I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years ago there was this sort of like what you might call a queercore band called Power Bottom. Do you remember that story?
Mm-hmm. I don't remember the story. I remember the band. Yeah. So there being a story about
the
that,
front man was accused essentially of sexual assault or something to that end. And I had never seen such a swift reaction. The album was canceled. The tour was canceled. And if you look at the internet now, it's like that band just never existed. Mm-hmm. But that guy is back and now putting out music under his own name, and nobody's saying anything about it. So, you know, what is it just about getting caught up in a moment? And then you get, you know, is this a product of kind of like the way that social media has made certain cultural things become, you know, it's very tricky because it's people who want to do right. I think whenever this happens, I don't see it as this, you know, some people might say, oh, it's just this mob mentality. I don't really see it that way. I think it is people who want to do the right thing. But it's applied so,
inconsistently.
Inconsistently, exactly. Yeah. That it's just tricky to say. So I don't know. I don't really have a lot of good stuff to say about that, I guess.
Well, you only got a few minutes left, so if we could end on something a little bit more fun, I would hate to turn down an opportunity to talk about James Pants. You write about him in the book. You're both from Spokane. He remains my best friend, and he had told me this story, and I'd forgotten that you'd written this piece, that you'd met him in China during this tour. So you write about you know, this guy from Spokane coming out to China while you're out there teaching English. He told me about the restaurant that you met at. What I remember two things that he told me. And the first may not be true, but he told me that penis was on the menu. I don't know which animal, but that the name of the restaurant is Kevin. And
I can confirm the second one. I don't remember. I mean, it's entirely possible that, I mean, you know, in China they do eat all parts of the animal. So yeah,
I liked those two potential facts put together, though. The name of the restaurant just being Kevin.
My favorite fact that I mentioned there is that they ran out of rice.
What?
The restaurant ran out of rice halfway through our meal.
So I'm pretty sure that was the tour that he invited me to play guitar on that tour.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I had an hourly call center job that I couldn't just leave. The self-importance of youth.
It's so funny. I once tried to become the tour drummer of the Seattle band Delure under similar circumstances, but it did not work out.
We without mentioning Shane's name, we brought him up on the last podcast because I worked with Shane in my very first job.
Oh, wow.
I've known him a long time. And so Tell us about this experience, if you can, in the amount of time you have left before you got to go, teaching English in China, encountering a fellow Spokaneite.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, whatever. Teaching in China was cool, and it put me on the trajectory that my career ended up on, and that's why I do what I do now, which is great. But when I heard he was coming, I was still doing a lot of music freelancing, like music criticism freelancing at the time. I was like, oh, this would be really fun. And it was, I don't do a lot of the traditional like journalism. And so it was really fun to just be like, you know, Dateline, Shanghai, we're eating pigeons. Like I got to my version of gonzoing it up a little bit, you know, which is like, I stayed at a youth hostel and like, I was trying to sleep, but like the guy in the bunk next to me came in and threw up, you know, it's not me doing gonzo stuff, but it's like, whatever. But so it was just super fun to just like, I wanted to do a true like music journalism piece. Like, what is the cultural significance of this? Like, who is this guy? bring this music to China? What does it mean to bring like Western indie music to China? What does that mean culturally? What does it mean for the artist? What does it mean for the culture and stuff? And I was pretty happy with the way it turned out. Like, it was pretty fun to see him in that element, and just to kind of, I had never done that kind of, it was the first time I ever did a sort of like, I'm embedded. So I spent like the whole day with him. So I went to an in-store that he did at like a clothing store, and I went to dinner with them, and I went to the sound check, and I just went to everything.
This
the
is only what, time 2005?
Probably 2007, I think, or 7 or 8, because that's when I was in China. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. But it was just really fun, and it was just interesting. And I interviewed everybody that I encountered. So the promoters and his manager and the people who ran the club. And I don't know, it just turned out to be a really fun thing that was not only about just, hey, here's a guy and here's his music. I didn't talk a ton about what his music was or what it sounded like, because the original outlet was the Hometown Weekly, which I figured people were already familiar with his music. So it was just an opportunity to just dig into like, what does this mean to me, to him, to the setting that we're in at large. And I really had a blast writing it, and it turned out really well. They made me do photos in order to pay me the $200 that I asked for when I originally, I was a horrible photographer, and it was I think they printed like one photo that I took. And when I had this crappy digital camera, I did take a picture of James eating a pigeon's head, which I can send you a link to.
Oh yeah, please do.
Put it in your show notes.
I'd love to see that.
All right.
Yeah, we talk pretty regularly. So yeah
you got to run. Where can people find you on the interwebs before you go?
Sure. So I have a website, joelhanghartsey.com. Hartsey is spelled H-A-R-T-S-E. You can order my new book or my previous book on there. I am on Twitter at Joel Hang Hartsey, but I don't, like I said last time, I don't really recommend following me on there. You can if you want.
We expect good baseball content though.
Yeah, definitely. Also, if you want to order the book, it's called Dancing About Architecture is a Reasonable Thing to Do. And I do have a discount code that I think still works. So it's IMAGE40. IMAGE40. Nice. And if you buy it direct from the publisher, Wipf and Stock Publishing or Cascade Books, you can use that. So feel free. But thank you guys so much. I'm sorry that I have to run. I love talking to you guys, and I love listening to your show. I really like the way that you handle this stuff. You handle it with a lot of nuance and grace, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joel. Thank you. Yeah. Come down to Seattle. Let's watch some baseball.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Well, David's great catching up with Joel. I'm so glad that he's getting to go on another podcast now and promote the book, and I hope that that broadens the web of people that know about Joel and what he's up to. He's a great guy to talk to. So
yeah,
I feel lucky that to have gotten to know him so long ago, and it's cool to see what he's doing these days.
I enjoy talking to him as well. It'd be awesome to watch some baseball with him, even if the Mariners are going to be bad this year. They are 2 wins and 4 losses as we are recording this. That will change when this comes out. Hopefully, we'll have more wins. But yeah, I have not finished the book like you, so I failed at my homework. But what I did read of the book, it is really interesting.
Different
I'm not a musician.
Styles.
Yeah, reading about kind of music criticism and the thoughtfulness of criticism and how we approach that as an audience. And really, it's critics sometimes get a bad rap, and there's populist people out there who attack critics as elitists. And Joel talks a little bit about this in his book, but really we're all critics. Criticism is just thoughtfully analyzing why I might like a piece of music or why I might like a film or how a film or music makes me think or feel. And I think it's just digging into why that is, so like what life experiences do I have that
I think there's a real semantics issue where a lot of people think that criticism is just negative commentary, and real criticism is exploration of an art. That's it
Yeah.
And as I've heard Joel say on other things, like, he's not all that interested in writing about music that he doesn't personally enjoy. Like, that's the fun stuff to write about. What, especially if it's some little band, like, what's the value in writing some piece to slam, you know, some tiny little group that just put out their first record or whatever and is, you know, trying to make a name for themselves and learning their craft, whatever. You know, you hope they get better, but it's not really worth writing a piece just to crap all over them. So
that's interesting, the ethics of writing criticism. That's an interesting thing to think about.
But it's just like, you know, a lot of people think that movie criticism is just a letter grade. You know, it's, is this good or bad? Is it fresh or rotten? You know,
beneath 60% or above 60%, which I think is
it's, you know, right, the job of a critic is to explore the ideas in the art, to encourage people to seek out things they otherwise wouldn't know about, to champion the good stuff that moves them. All of these things are part of it. And I wish we had a separate word for the act of negative commentary versus this thoughtful, nuanced approach.
Thoughtful analysis,
talking and exploring art. So,
but analysis sounds too boring. It sounds too scientific. So we do need a. We do.
So we all get hung up on the word criticism.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
and now and then we see people say nobody ever built a statue to a critic, and then people will like respond with, "Oh yeah, here's a statue of Roger Ebert in Chicago. Here's a statue of the, you know, there's various arts cultural critics that have had statues built to them because they were that meaningful to their community." So,
absolutely. This has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Make sure you pick up Joel Hang Hartsey's new book, out right now wherever books are sold. Dancing About Architecture is a Reasonable Thing to Do. You can follow Joel on Twitter at Joel Hang Hartsey, as he was talking about. You can follow our show at VCW Pod. I am at Dave J. Lester. Zach is at Muzach, M-U-Z-A-C-H. And you can go to Zach's website, muzach.bandcamp.com. You can get his vinyl Christmas album and listen to some of the other music that he hasn't played live, but you can find it on his website, and it's very good, so check that out. Music and logo for this show done by Zach.
Thanks again for coming on down to VCW. And remember, as always, the podcast is free, but you still need to tithe 10%.